And so they looked through medical records and they found, based on the data of 60,000 people, that the babies who were developing when the moms were eating only 40 grams of sugar had a 15% lower risk of having developed diabetes in their whole life.
Did you wear a CGM during your pregnancy?
I was reading all the information about how your glucose levels basically become your baby's glucose levels when you're pregnant. Mm. And so I was wearing it to see what would happen to my body, because during pregnancy, we get more insulin resistant.
I used to sip old balsamic vinegar, undiluted, and a small piece of my tooth broke off.
No way. Because of that, you think?
Yeah.
And there's incredible data, for example, a study from Cornell University that shows that when you supplement with 1.2 grams of DHA per day during pregnancy, you can increase your baby's IQ.
Herzlich willkommen zu Mission Gesundheit. Ich bin Dr. Hadi Saleh. Wir hören hier ständig, wie wichtig Ernährung für unsere Gesundheit ist. Aber wann beginnt gesunde Ernährung eigentlich wirklich? Vielleicht viel früher, als wir denken. Nicht erst im Kindesalter oder wenn wir anfangen, selbst Entscheidungen zu treffen, sondern möglicherweise schon während der Schwangerschaft. Genau darüber sprechen wir heute. Denn die Ernährung der Mutter kann offenbar viel stärker beeinflussen, wie sich ein Kind entwickelt, als vielen bewusst ist. Und deshalb freue ich mich sehr auf meinen heutigen Gast. Experte der Woche. Ich habe nämlich Jessie Introsper eingeladen. Viele kennen sie als die Glucose Goddess. Sie ist Biochemikerin, Ernährungsexpertin und Bestsellerautorin. Mit ihren Büchern über Blutzucker und Ernährung hat sie weltweit Millionen Menschen erreicht. Jetzt beschäftigt sie sich in ihrem neuen Buch, 9 Monate, die ein Leben lang zählen, mit der Frage, wie Ernährung in der Schwangerschaft die Zukunft eines Babys prägen kann. Die Folge ist auf Englisch. Ich wünsche euch ganz viel Spaß. Jessie, very good to see you. Thank you very much for joining the podcast. I cannot believe that the glucose goddess is joining me. And I have to ask, what have you eaten today?
So I just ate, just 1 minute ago, a big omelette with a small salad with vinegar and a piece of dark chocolate just before I came on to meet you. And this morning, I actually didn't have a lot of time, so I had a big coffee with protein powder inside of it. That's what I do when I don't have time to have a proper breakfast.
I have never tried that.
It's because, so this is a whole secret, and I can tell you offline, but so far there have been no protein powders that are good enough to put in your coffee until now. So I'll tell you afterwards, but there's a little secret coming. Yes.
So you wrote the book, The Glucose Goddess Method, and before we get into your new book, if you reflect, you know, what you know today and back then, is there anything that you now see differently or approach with a little bit more nuance? Or do you think everything holds true until today?
I think things still hold true, because when you think about, you know, that book, what I was really doing is talking about some pretty common sense stuff, like avoiding sugar in the morning, you know, moving after eating, having more vegetables, but just explaining them through a new lens and with the work of continuous glucose monitors. Maybe something that I would change or that I think has evolved. I think the conversation around glucose monitors, you know, the actual device, I think that's something that's really ongoing. So maybe I would have added in that book a bit more information about the device, because it's come to my attention that through my work, you know, many people tried glucose monitors, and still to this day, I get messages on Instagram of people not being sure how to interpret the numbers. You know, it can be quite a confusing technology if you don't have enough context. So I think I could have done a better job, like putting a whole section in the book about glucose monitor data. So that's maybe my one regret, that I didn't do enough of that part. But on all the rest, it still holds completely true. And then what's interesting is that I'm seeing more and more studies come out about glucose spikes in people without diabetes, you know, more and more studies on food order, on vinegar, etc. So if anything, I feel like I could do an updated version of the book with even more studies, but things hold true. Yeah.
Did you wear a CGM during your pregnancy?
I did actually. Yeah, absolutely. I think it was for a few reasons. I mean, one, I was reading all the information about how your glucose levels basically become your baby's glucose levels when you're pregnant. And so I was wearing it to see what would happen to my body, because during pregnancy, we get more insulin resistant. And so I wanted to see the change in the spikes, which was really quite shocking. And in my book, I did a test of eating a cookie every month during pregnancy, and you see the spike getting bigger and bigger every month. And then I was also wearing it for motivation, which I think is a big driver today of when I want to wear one, because I was trying to be really good about my sugar intake. And so by having the feedback of the curve, it was just like I had an ally, you know, a little coach in my pocket to help me with that goal.
Yeah, I actually do the same, you know, every year I'll slap one on or maybe, you know, two, so I get a full month just to sensitize myself again, you know, to be more mindful and see how my body reacts to different food.
Totally. And I even wore it while giving birth. So I have the glucose curve of my, in the book at the very end, in the birth chapter, I have the glucose curve of giving birth. Which is kind of remarkable to see, because you can see, you know, my glucose getting higher and higher and higher. I wasn't eating anything in particular, but it was just, you know, the glycogen being dropped in my bloodstream from my uterus, I guess, to be able to have energy. So that was pretty cool.
It's hard work, you know. This is why they probably called it to being in labor, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
During your research while you were pregnant, was there, you know, a moment where you thought to yourself, holy shit, you know, why hasn't anybody, you know, prior to me looked into this?
So I think many people have looked into it. And there are already, you know, good books on the topic. But the holy shit moment for me was like, why is nobody talking about this science that exists? So I was really trying to, like in my other work, you know, I'm not the researcher myself doing the research in terms of, you know, in the lab or epidemiologically, but I really felt like there was lacking communication about all this science. I think the oh shit moment was maybe when I saw the research about choline intake and how it can have an impact on measurable aspects of a baby's brain development, like years after birth. Or this really famous study from the UK that looked at 60,000 people, and that showed that when we cut our sugar intake by half during pregnancy, we can reduce the likelihood of our baby getting diabetes in his own life. And so for me, I was like, oh my God, like what we're doing during these 9 months really matters for the rest of the life of our child. And I think that was a really big moment when I didn't realize all the power that I actually had during pregnancy.
So you've already started hinting at a key nutrient for the baby's development with choline. Can you take us to the other key nutrients in that you found out during your research for the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So choline is a big one, and it forms the baby's brain, and it comes from animal foods and especially from the egg yolks. So that's something to really keep in mind and to try to have enough of. So I was having 3 or 4 eggs a day to get enough choline during pregnancy. And another key nutrient is protein. So when we're building a baby from scratch, the baby needs a lot of protein to build his body. And as the mom, like, you're in charge of giving enough protein to your child. So that's the other second one. The third one is omega-3 DHA. So that's a substance that comes from algae and fish, and that builds the baby's brain cell connections. And there's incredible data, for example, a study from Cornell University that shows that when you supplement with 1.2 grams of DHA per day during pregnancy, you can increase your baby's IQ. So in that particular clinical trial, they found a 4-point IQ increase at 4 years old in the kids who were in the wombs of moms that were being supplemented with DHA. So that's pretty striking. And today, you know, we have very low omega-3 levels as a whole. And getting enough omega-3s can also reduce the risk of premature birth. So it's a really, really powerful nutrient. And today, 75% to 80% of moms are unfortunately not hitting the target set by the European Union on how much omega-3s to have during pregnancy. So those are the three that we need to add more of: choline, protein, and omega-3s. And then the last one is glucose. And this is not so much a question of adding more glucose during pregnancy. It's more a question of understanding that your baby doesn't actually need you to double your carb and sugar intake. Your baby needs a little bit of glucose during pregnancy, but really you're better off trying to reduce how much sugar you're eating to help the programming of the metabolism of your baby. And there are also, you know, many other important things during pregnancy. But to me, what I was seeing is that in these four nutrients, there was a real combination of factors. One, they were very important. And two, most moms were lacking in the first three, like significantly lacking in the first three, and then getting way too much of the last one. So there was a real discrepancy between the importance and then how many moms were getting to the proper levels, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. You know, I have three kids. And, well, actually, my wife had the three kids. I just was donating my DNA and watching from the sideline. and I wish, you know, we had your book back then. You know, my kids are teenagers now, because, you know, I'm a physician. I didn't know this.
And how do you explain that? How do you explain the lack of knowledge, you know? Because the science has been existing for a very long time.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. You know, it's because nobody speaks about this. You know, it's so in med school, you get taught to treat diseases and not preventing diseases. So this is, you know, one thing that I'm focusing on today, on preventive diagnostics, but also doing the best you can for the child that is in your womb is not taught. Let's try to clarify a couple of myths. You know, you said one, you need to eat for two, you know, is something that I hear all the time. My child number two and three were twins, so my wife had to eat for three. But this is wrong, you know, and omitting to your cravings, you know, is what do you think about that?
I think there's different categories of cravings. I think, so first of all, you know, many moms, including myself, can have very intense nausea. So in the first trimester, I was very nauseous and very sick. And at that point, honestly, I couldn't eat anything else but carbs and chocolates. Like, it was just physiological. It was impossible. So I think for that phase, it's important to just do whatever we can. And then in terms of cravings, I think we see two categories. We see the cravings for things like pickles or meat or fruit. And these can sometimes point to real needs that your body has. So for example, the craving for salty foods and pickles, this can point to your body needing more iodine, which is important for the baby's growth. A craving meat, for example, I mean, that's obvious. It's a protein and iron. And then craving fruit can often be you're craving vitamins. But if you're craving, like, you know, 25 triple chocolate fudge cookies with whipped cream, that's probably not like a real biological need. It's probably something else, which is quite unfair, which is that it seems that during pregnancy, women are going to be more attracted to sugar and get more dopamine signaling in the brain from the same amount of sugar. So there's this study, this Spanish study done on rats, where they found that in pregnant rats, the center, the part of the brain that is registering the dopamine from eating something sweet develops more receptors during pregnancy. So the same cookie might be leading to more feelings of enjoyment in the brain. And from a sort of evolutionary perspective, this might make sense, right? Because you're pregnant, so you need to make sure you're having as many fruit as you can find. But today, where you can order on your phone, you know, the 5 liters of ice cream, it's sort of backfiring a little bit. That being said, I experienced it too, like this craving for sugar and for calorie-rich foods. And so in those cases, I think it's not about, you know, restricting, because that's hard and not very healthy. It's more about learning how you can eat the stuff that you really want to eat in a way that's going to create a bit less spiking and inflammation in your body. So, for example, if you want to eat 12 cookies, you know, have them after lunch instead of for breakfast on an empty stomach. And if you can, you know, move your body a little bit after eating them, you know, clean your apartment, do a few dishes so that your body is absorbing some of that sugar and not letting it all go through to your baby. And then during pregnancy, if you can, for example, say, okay, instead of 15 cookies, I'm going to have 14 cookies. This is already going to be a positive impact on your child, because we have to remember, and this is something that really is a big myth, when we're pregnant, everything we eat goes into our bloodstream and then into the baby's bloodstream. It's a direct connection. There is no filtering process. The placenta, which is the organ that brings the mom's bloodstream and the baby's bloodstream in very close connection, the placenta does not, you know, think about what he needs to let through and, you know, make sure that this doesn't come in, this doesn't come in. The placenta largely trusts that whatever is in high concentration in the mom's blood belongs in high concentration in the baby's blood. And that's why it's important to not drink alcohol and not take toxic drugs, because they go to the baby. Mm. The same thing is true for everything that we eat. It all goes to the baby. So when you have the 15 cookies, there's a lot of sugar that makes its way to the baby's developing body. And this sends signals to the child. It says, okay, you're going to be born into a world with a lot of sugar. So prepare yourself, you know, become really good at storing fat, increase your insulin levels, you know, and it's preparing the baby's body in a way that might create vulnerabilities to things like obesity and diabetes later in life. And that's a pretty scary thought. But biologically, it's true. So I think it's important to make sure that people are aware of that biological truth.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned also, referenced the UK study that you mentioned earlier, where there was, you know, sugar rationing during the war. And I think it lasted for, you know, 10 to 14 years. And so they could study, you know, babies that were born in that phase and compare the lifetime risk for diabetes. Can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, you're completely right. So for these 13 years in the UK, the whole country went from eating 80 grams of added sugar per day to eating 40 grams of added sugar per day, because there was a countrywide rationing of how much sugar you were allowed to have. And this is not fruit, right? This is the added white table sugar. And so 60 years later, scientists wondered, well, you know, the babies who were developing in the womb of the moms during the sugar rationing, is there anything that happened to them later on that we could see and measure? And so they looked through medical records and they found, based on the data of 60,000 people, that the babies who were developing when the moms were eating only 40 grams of sugar had a 15% lower risk of having developed diabetes in their whole life. So what does that tell us? It tells us that what happens during these 9 months, which is a very short window when you think about a whole life, right? What happens during these 9 months is something of outsized importance that has an impact on the calibration of organs, of metabolism, of the brain. It's a moment of high sensitivity and of high impact and high importance. And the way I like to see it is like when your baby is developing inside the mom's body, he doesn't have any information about the world he's going to be born into, right? He can't see it. He can't ask questions. He's just getting information through the environment the mom is creating in her own body. And so when the mom is eating very high sugar intake, the baby's getting that information that the world is going to be very high in sugar. Similarly, when the mom eats very low protein during pregnancy, the baby gets the message, you're going to be born into a world with very low protein. So keep your muscles very small. Maybe, you know, some organs, you're not going to be able to finish them completely because there's just not enough building blocks. And all these messages are sort of postcards we're sending to the baby. And we're not even aware that we're doing this, right? Nobody's telling us that through our diet, we are helping our baby shape his body and his brain based on the world that he thinks he's going to be born into. So it's quite important that we try to send a message that is reflective of a healthy environment and a healthy world, because that's going to calibrate epigenetically the DNA of the child. So anyway, it's just fascinating information.
Yeah, I called my mother and asked her what she was eating during her pregnancy with me. Yeah. And unfortunately, she cannot remember. It's too long ago.
I did the same thing. And my mom said that she was having mostly, you know, very sweet, sugary stuff. No eggs, probably like a normal amount of protein. And actually, when I was 25 years old, I was very close to having prediabetes. My glucose was like 99 milligrams and prediabetes is 100. And I was 25 and I could never really explain it. You know, I wasn't eating particularly worse than my peers. And looking back now that I have this information, I wonder if maybe my mom's very high sugar diet when she was pregnant with me could have had an influence on my vulnerability. I mean, many things. I never got the disease because, you know, I caught it and I was able to do the glucose hacks and fix it. But it's interesting to wonder. It's interesting to wonder if today we would feel different in our brain, in our body, if our moms had eaten differently.
It's very difficult to find out now. We will probably never know.
Exactly.
And it would be unethical.
We'll do the best we can, you know?
Yeah. And I think it would be unethical to do a clinical study on it.
Yeah, that's one of the main problems we have with this area of research, right? Like, we cannot run clinical trials on humans. We can't say to 500 moms, you know, eat very poorly and to the other 500 eat very well and measure what happens to the babies. So scientists draw on two sources of data. Animal studies, which are very, very common to measure the effects, because in animal studies, we can obviously, you know, control these variables more. Supplementation studies. So it's okay ethically to give some moms like an omega-3 supplement and others a placebo and to measure that. So we have a ton of those. And then a lot of observational associative data, like the UK study, which is kind of the closest thing to a natural controlled experiment that we have.
So you just touched on it, supplementation. I do imagine, or I know for a fact, that most, if not all, of the pregnant women will not eat fatty fish in the right amount to cover their omega-3 needs. What's your take on supplementation in general?
That's a vast topic. I think supplementation in general is like saying, you know, what's your take on beverages in general? It's like, well, it depends on the beverage, you know. I think the supplements that are specifically trying to fill a nutritional gap make a lot of sense. Like, for example, you know, omega-3s is a perfect example. Like, the health agencies worldwide say that moms should be eating 300 milligrams additional DHA per day during pregnancy. And most moms are not getting that. It's through food. So if you're supplementing and it's allowing you to get that established biological need, then that's great. I think same thing for choline also. In some cases, for example, in the choline case, a supplement is going to be less well absorbed than the formin food. But we see some pretty incredible data. As I mentioned, the 1.2 grams of DHA per day and the 4-point IQ increase. We also have another study with 2.2 grams of DHA during pregnancy, and the kids have a 6% better hand-eye coordination score when they're 2.5 years old. So that's pretty interesting. And then in the world of choline, for example, we also have some pretty strong data. So there was one study done at Cornell, which gave some moms 430 milligrams per day of choline or 930 milligrams per day in the third trimester. And then the babies came in when they were in their first year of life. And they measured the reaction time, which is a standardized measurement of sort of brain functioning. And they saw the kids who were developing with more choline had a faster reaction time. And that's this amazing. Test is correlated to IQ as an adult. It is amazing. It is amazing. We also see similar supplementation results on choline and emotional regulation at 3 years old. So parents report that babies are more emotionally regulated when they're 3 years old, when there's been the choline supplementation. So, I mean, in many cases, it's really interesting. Especially, I think, it's safest when we're talking about supplementation that is filling an actual nutritional gap. So, you know, the obvious ones are iron. When you're pregnant, you often get an iron supplement, vitamin D supplement, you know, has really good evidence behind it. Yeah. Folate, oh my God, of course. That's a huge one. That's a huge one. You know, in France, it's actually, so I'm French, and folate in France is still something that is not adopted at all. Like most of my friends don't even take folate when they're pregnant because the doctors don't tell them about it. So I think the data is that only 30% of pregnant moms in France take folate. 30%, even though we know it has a very strong correlation with neural tube defects and risk of miscarriage, et cetera. So anyway, we have a long ways to go. What do you think about supplements, Heidi?
I'm a big fan, but only if you have a deficit and you need to recalibrate basically, or fill up your deficit. And oftentimes, less is more. But there are, you know, you mentioned it, you know, vitamin D, omega-3, magnesium are, you know, the top three on my list.
Totally.
And then it gets very personalized. So I don't believe in, I think if you don't take anything and you're malnourished, you know, a good multivitamin, and there's good evidence for this, you know, helps and improves your general health. But if you can afford to measure your blood and look at all the micronutrients and see if you're deficient in one or two, then addressing those, I think, is super helpful.
Yeah, but I mean, it's even better to address them through food, right?
Yeah, always. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are issues like nausea, cravings, energy crashes that are very, very common during pregnancy. What role does the blood sugar play in all of this?
It's one of the factors that affects these symptoms. For example, in the case of nausea, so we don't have a solution yet. Apart from if you have a very intense form, there's some medication. But really, for most moms, it's just a matter of waiting it out. But we do know a few things. We know that protein helps reduce a little bit the sensation of nausea. And we know that being on a blood sugar roller coaster can increase the feeling of nausea, especially during the glucose crash. So that's why, that's yet another reason why managing your glucose levels during pregnancy is a helpful thing, because it also helps alleviate symptoms. Same thing for fatigue. I mean, that's a huge thing. You know, energy crashes are massive. And if you compound that with a glucose roller coaster, it's going to be even more exhausting for your body. So to me, you know, glucose regulation during pregnancy or not, by the way, is just such a baseline, fundamental part of physical and mental health that we should always be looking at it and making sure that we're actively trying to balance it.
Yeah, and in that aspect, you know, what you've written in your previous book, you know, all the hacks still hold true. You know, it's still, so I follow, I love vinegar. And I do as you recommended, and have a tablespoon of vinegar and in a glass of water. I learned the hard way, so to tell you a personal story. I used to sip old balsamic vinegar, you know, in a shot glass, undiluted, and a small piece of my tooth broke off. So
no
I now know,
because of
my
that,
dentist
you
asked me, I'm pretty sure, because it was down here and it was just the tip. And my dentist asked me, so what did you do? I said, maybe it's the vinegar. And
Said,
yeah, absolutely, you dummy.
And, that's so bad.
So now I know for sure, you know, always dilute it in a glass of water.
And if you can use a straw also.
Yeah, yeah. That's a brilliant idea. I wish I knew that 5 years ago. So. it's all good now. It's all good now. But and again, you know, you know this, but for our viewers and listeners, you know, eat your fiber first, you know, and the protein and then the carbs, you know, it still holds true. And walking after eating.
Yeah. And so maybe to touch on that a little bit more. So first of all, the vinegar thing. So what's going on and why does it work? So this is not random. This is real scientific evidence behind it. So vinegar contains a molecule called acetic acid, which is really interesting and powerful because it slows down how quickly in your digestive system carbs, so things like bread, pasta, rice, or anything sweet, gets broken down into glucose molecules. So that means that when we have one tablespoon of vinegar in a big glass of water like this, before we eat something high in carbs, it reduces how quickly the carbs actually hit our bloodstream. Therefore, it reduces the glucose spike of the carbs. And this means we're still having the carbs, but we're getting less of a spike, less of a crash, meaning less inflammation and less feeling of craving and more sugar, hunger, cravings after that meal. So it's quite powerful, and it helps reduce that cycle of, you know, spike, crash, crave, spike, crash, crave. And then you mentioned the fiber first. That's also a very important hack to use to try to always eat your vegetables at the beginning of your meal, or to start all the meals with vegetables, especially the meals that are going to be very high in carbs. So if, for example, if you're going to have a pizza, you know, have a big salad before. If you're going to have pasta, have some carrots or broccoli before, because the fiber in those vegetables, it creates a protective mesh in your intestine. And again, it's all about the speed of the glucose. It slows down how quickly the glucose arrives in the blood. It's all about velocity. And then you can also combine the two hacks and have a salad with a vinegar dressing, or, you know, some vegetables with a little vinegar sauce on top. And that's a double hack for your glucose.
No, this is great. I have to ask you, you know, a different topic, but it's related to food intake or nutrition intake in general. Your take on microplastics during pregnancy.
I mean, it's a very early, right? We have, you know, we have only a few years of research, but what's going on is that we see in many studies that researchers are finding microplastics in the placenta, meaning that microplastics around us are potentially making their way into our babies, even starting in the womb, which is pretty wild. And
it's scary.
Yeah, it's a bit scary. And, you know, there's also studies showing we have microplastics in our brain. I mean, they're a little bit everywhere. We don't know exactly what the long-term effect of this is going to be, but let's just say that it's probably not good to have more microplastics in your placenta. So it's helpful, you know, all the time to try to reduce our exposure, you know, so you want to stop drinking water that is in plastic bottles and use filters at home if you can. You don't want to heat anything, for example, in a microwave in a plastic box. So if you order takeout, you know, immediately take it out of the hot plastic box and put it in another box. I also, you know, try to not touch receipts which are full of this specific lighting plastic, which gets under the skin very quickly. So listen, we live in the modern world, you know, plastic is all around us. But specifically, drinking in the bottles and heating plastic is two of the biggest things we can do. And also avoiding tea bags that are plastic. That's a big one, because a tea bag that's plastic, you put boiling water on top and that liberates so many microplastics. So I drink tea from this French brand that makes tea bags with basically cloth, with like mousseline. So it's cotton, which is amazing.
I have to ask you the last question. You've been very generous with your time. If you could give just one key piece of advice to an expecting mother, what would it be?
Have 4 eggs a day to make sure that your baby's getting enough choline for their brain. Have a little can of sardines or anchovies 3 times a week. So you're asking for one piece, but I'm doing several. Sorry.
Yeah, give me more. That's fine.
3 or 4 eggs a day, a fatty fish 3 times a week, protein at every meal. Try to reduce a little bit your sugar intake. And then if you can, supplement with some extra omega-3s, because there's good evidence that going above the 3 servings a week can be helpful for your baby. And the last piece of advice is, if you don't do any of this, your baby will be fine. Most of us have developed in wombs with none of this, and we're completely okay. We're talking about like some, you know, small optimizations we can make. And just remember, we all do our best. And when it comes to the fundamentals of growing a baby, which is a body, water, and food, we have those. So that's really all that matters.
Tracy, thank you so much for your time and for everything that you do. You know, you are helping to educate, you know, the general public, not only on glucose metabolism, which is a key factor in living healthy and ultimately longer and a healthier life. But now, you know, you've taken the chance, you know, to do the research on nutrition during pregnancy and the effect on babies, which is so valuable. You know, I said it before, I wish I had this book, you know, decades ago, to know, you know, what to look after. So thank you very much. What you do is very, very important, and it helps to propel humanity into a better state of life. Thank you.
Wow, that's quite the compliment. Thank you so much, Hadi. Appreciate it.
Die Fakten der Folge. Wir wissen jetzt, Blutzucker spielt in der Schwangerschaft eine viel größere Rolle, als viele denken, weil starke Schwankungen nicht nur die Energie, den Hunger oder das Wohlbefinden der Mutter beeinflussen, sondern auch die Entwicklung des Babys und später sogar das Risiko für bestimmte Erkrankungen mitprägen können. Besonders wichtig für die Entwicklung des Babys sind laut Jesse bestimmte zentrale Nährstoffe, die unter anderem Gehirn, Stoffwechsel und Wachstum beeinflussen und von denen viele Schwangere oft nicht ausreichend versorgt sind. Und drittens, es braucht meist keine perfekte Ernährung oder komplizierte Regeln. Oft machen schon kleine Veränderungen im Alltag einen Unterschied, zum Beispiel ein vernünftiger Umgang mit Zucker, mehr Protein und Ballaststoffe oder bewusstere Mahlzeiten. Also wie Jesse sagt, macht euch nicht verrückt, ihr macht das gut. Random Reminder. Random Reminder, atme langsamer, wenn der Kopf zu laut wird. Stress macht die Atmung oft automatisch schneller und flacher. Dadurch bleibt dein Nervensystem im Alarmmodus. Versuch daher mal bewusst langsamer zu atmen. Zum Beispiel 4 Sekunden ein und 6 Sekunden aus. Das längere Ausatmen aktiviert den Vagusnerv und signalisiert deinem Körper, Gefahr vorbei. Oft reichen schon wenige Atemzüge, damit der Kopf wieder ruhiger wird. Also mal Random Reminder heute. Dein Atem ist der schnellste Weg, dein Nervensystem zu beeinflussen. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Bleib gesund und neugierig. Das war Mission Gesundheit mit mir, Dr. Hadi Sadeh. Danke, dass ihr Teil dieser wachsenden Community seid. Unterstützt den Podcast gerne mit einem Like, Kommentar oder einem Follow. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Bleibt gesund und neugierig.